This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Saturday, September 5th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. When the federal government finalized plans to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling, environmentalists were both at the table, in fighting the project wholesale, but also not at the table in terms of having a shot at bidding for those oil leases. Sean Regan, a vice president at the Property and Environment Research Center, argues that even a little injection of property rights into the leasing process would likely mean good things for conservation. The issue of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge has been on the radar, particularly, I think, of Republicans, at least since 2008. Am I wrong in that?
The debate over ANWR drilling dates back decades to when Congress authorized drilling to take place there, and it's been a political football, you know, through many, many different administrations over the past several decades. Just now getting to the point of some resolution in terms of direction from Congress about what to do as it relates to drilling in ANWR.
This story didn't really make a lot of waves, and I think it maybe it should have, that the Trump administration has finalized plans to allow for the auctioning of oil and gas rights in the heart of ANWR. So from the perspective of people who'd like to prevent that from happening, what do they see as the big threat?
Well, this is a wildlife refuge. It's 19 million acres, and the area in question here is a much smaller portion of that larger wildlife refuge. And there's still a lot of unknowns. We don't know exactly how much oil there is to be drilled, but this has long been, you know, viewed as one of the largest remaining reserves of oil in the United States. And so for many decades, it's been a target of folks who would like to see more resource development in this region. But it's also, of course, a wildlife refuge, and it's home to a lot of important habitat for caribou, migratory birds, lots of other species. And this is mostly an untouched area without roads and without any other sorts of development in there. So it's certainly been controversial. We're at the point now where Congress has directed the Interior Department to initiate some lease sales over the next several years. This dates back to the 2017 tax reform package. A provision in that bill tasked the Interior Department with looking into this and actually conducting a lease sale, which is the point we're at today.
So I think you and I have discussed this in different contexts, which is the idea of timber leases on public lands. ANWR is government property. Are leases and these auctions for leases, is that really the best way to go about this? And is it properly respectful of the fact that there are some people who would frankly prefer that this didn't happen at all?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, you know, the debate over ANWR in particular has long sort of, to us at PERC, highlighted the pitfalls of what we call political environmentalism and the benefits of what we call free market environmentalism. And so if you think about this from a sort of a property rights perspective, what we often talk about in the ANWR context is, imagine what would happen if environmentalists owned ANWR or owned this portion of ANWR. You know, what might they do, and how might their behavior be different than we see in this political arena where these decisions are made from the top down through these political processes that are fraught with, you know, with conflict. And so, you know, what's interesting about ANWR is that, it's of course been controversial, but you look at a lot of the groups that have been opponents of drilling, such as the Audubon Society and other groups, and ask, what would these groups, if they owned the land, how would they act differently? And so one of the things we've looked at PERC is, what do these environmental groups do when they own their own land, and how do they behave as it relates to things like oil drilling? And in some cases, you know, as we've documented, the Audubon Society owns this preserve in Louisiana called the Rainy Sanctuary. And the group has actually for decades had done oil drilling on their own lands. And you might ask, well, why would some environmental group who's opposed to drilling in ANWR actually drill on their own land? And I think it demonstrates just how property rights, when there's ownership rights of the resource, even when it's environmental groups, it fundamentally changes the way that they view the trade-offs associated with different uses or non-uses of their land. And so in the Audubon Society's case in Louisiana, they were able to find ways to conduct drilling operations, you know, under strict environmental standards to protect bird habitat and other wildlife habitat, do it at certain times of the year when it wasn't going to affect, you know, nesting birds and other things like that, but do it in a way where they could earn royalties and use those royalties to better protect bird habitat, perhaps in other areas. And in the case of the Rainy Preserve, Audubon reportedly earned, you know, $25 million in royalties that they could use to purchase and protect even more land. So the point is that property rights really change the incentives. And, you know, we like to think about ways that, you know, even short of full property rights to something like ANWR, how could we inject a little bit more of that kind of thinking and that sort of rational approach to, I think, addressing these trade-offs in the context of something like ANWR? And we might see more sensible environmental outcomes as opposed to these like overly politicized all or nothing outcomes of, you know, you're either, it's either drill, baby, drill, or it's save the Arctic. And there's really a more reasonable, I think, middle ground here that if you had a more property rights-based, market-based approach that had something like ownership rights attached to it, that you might see a more sensible approach like that.
We've talked about sort of the upside if environmental groups were in charge. What about the flip side? What if oil companies were in charge of this land or owned this land or had certain rights over this land?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, the same holds true that ownership rights force groups to confront the trade-offs associated with different uses of the land and face the full opportunity costs of their actions. And so even when it comes to the flip side, when, if it's an energy company, say, that owns owns ANWR or owns the rights to ANWR, and those rights can be transferred to even conservation uses, then they do face those trade-offs. And, you know, oil markets are, it's an interesting issue as it relates to ANWR right now, and that it's happening right now. This leasing process is happening now when oil markets are in turmoil. There's a worldwide supply glut. Prices are low. At the time that this leasing was, that Congress instructed the Interior Department to do this leasing, the estimate was that this would generate $1 billion in revenue to offset tax cuts, was the purpose. Now those estimates are, you know, some groups have said it may be as little as $20 million that could be generated from this sale, given those market dynamics at the moment. So even in the case of an energy company, say, that owned the rights to this resource, you might see some very interesting and different outcomes than they sort of all or nothing drill or conserve, because there's certainly a lot of value in conservation value in this landscape. You see that in the amount of effort in the political arena and the legal arena as it relates to litigation that might come and has already happened in the ANWR context. And so there's clear value here. And now could those dollars by environmentalists be channeled in a more market-based way to, say, you know, acquire some portion of the rights or acquire some agreement where drilling could be done in a very environmentally sensitive manner? You could imagine a lot of interesting contractual market-based arrangements that would conserve portions or all of ANWR, even if it was controlled by an energy company.
What are the incentives typically faced by environmental groups in this kind of situation? It seems like their incentive is very clearly, we need to signal to our members that we are fighting this, not in part, but in whole. And presumably that is based on the land that these kinds of organizations already do own, that it is rooted in, well, there's no benefit to us financially to not oppose this wholesale.
Right. Under political environmentalism, you know, the incentives for compromise are practically zero. I mean, groups don't face the direct costs of their actions. You know, one side wins and the other side loses. I think it's interesting when you look at this case study of Audubon's privately owned preserve in Louisiana. You know, they certainly don't want to have a bad outcome as it relates to drilling, to the extent that they, you know, have conducted drilling there. So they have every incentive in the world to do that in the right way, because they don't want to upset their members who are not going to want to see, you know, oil spills or resource extraction done in an environmentally damaging way. And so they have, you know, all the reason in the world to get it right. And the other example in this is not just in Louisiana, but Audubon has a similar reserve in Michigan that they've done drilling on, or at least they've done out just beyond the boundaries of the refuge. They've done this slant drilling to access the resources beneath the refuge and earn royalties as a result of that, that would enable them to do even more, achieve even more conservation elsewhere and do it in a way that has little or no impact on the actual, within the boundaries of the refuge.
You know, the context of timber, the fact that they were auctioning off, I believe, timber leases, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, environmentalists were not at the table. That is, you could buy a lease, win your bid, but there was nothing that compelled the government or compelled the purchasers of those leases to pay a price that environmentalists thought that they ought to pay in order to undertake that lease. Is that true in Anwar as well? That is, can environmentalists buy these leases and then not use them?
Yeah, the short answer is no. Under current law and regulation governing the leasing of federal lands, generally no. And that's where, you know, we would like to see more of these sort of market mechanisms that open up the bidding process to encompass not just the extractive use value of these resources, but perhaps even the non-use conservation value of these resources. So short of full property rights, which, as we discussed, you know, provide all the right incentives to balance in a rational way resource development and conservation, you know, short of that, you could have a leasing system that at least opens up to other uses like conservation and allows conservationists to bid against energy developers. And you alluded to an example of a timber sale, and that's something that at least on some state lands in the West is something that is allowed to happen in certain circumstances. And we've seen when those institutions allow for conservationists to bid, they often do, and sometimes they win. And that happened here in our backyard in Bozeman recently, where a group that opposed a timber sale on some state land outbid the timber company, and they now have the right to preserve and keep the trees standing for 25 years. And so while it's not full property rights, it is a market-like mechanism to reflect the full suite of values that are associated with any landscape, whether that be for extractive use or non-extractive conservation values. And that's something that, you know, that with reform could happen in this Anwar context. And it may, you know, taxpayers may benefit in this case, which, as we mentioned, taxpayers don't stand to perhaps benefit as much as they as was hoped initially when Congress initiated this leasing program in Anwar.
Sean Regan is Vice President of Research at the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.